I'm going to talk to you about the public part of the ordination ceremony. It's funny though, I was just having a little walk with Holly and we were looking at the clothes and I thought maybe it'd be just better to look at the clothes. I felt a sort of reluctance to say anything in a way. For two reasons, partly because maybe it really is better to just do nothing and look at the clothes. Also, I think for years now, I've tried to give a number of talks on ordination, what it means and, in a sense, why bother, you know. And I feel like I never quite managed to say it. And in a way, maybe that's because maybe it does sort of defy rationality, really. I mean, in a certain sense, it's a bit of a crazy thing to do. Really, you know, in a way. I mean, although it's interesting, Diane Andy saying that I'm a very communal person, it does seem to have turned out that way, but my inside voice is probably saying, hope this doesn't shock you, you know, but quite a lot of the time, like, God, wouldn't life be easier if you don't have all these people to negotiate with and bother with? You know, wouldn't it all just be so much easier? So in a certain sense, why, that question of why do we bother to join an order really is a live question for me, although obviously here I am, I've done it, and you're all about to do it. So let me try again, you know, I'll try again, so maybe you'll join the order in spite of my talk. So the first, I have written a few things down. The first thing I've written down is, ordination is the basis of the order. Ordination is the basis of the order. It's so simple, isn't it? But it's so, and that is actually quite profound, really. Our whole order, ordination is the basis, and that is an amazing thing. What the amazing thing about that is that the whole thing is completely on the basis of trust. You know, still, even with thousands of us, it's entirely on the basis of trust. Sort of trust in this, trust in these retreats, trust in the ceremony that we're about to do together, and trust that everyone else understands that ceremony in the same way, wherever that ceremony takes place. Trust in the people conducting the ceremony, trust in, all on trust, you know. So once you're in the order, wherever you go in the Tree Ratna world, and it's, you know, we're, in one way we're a very small, tiny order, but in another way we span a bit of the world now. Wherever you turn up as an order member, you'll be welcomed as an order member. Somehow they'll know that something like this has happened. They won't know the details, but they'll know, whoever, I'm going to say the other order member who welcomes you, or Mitra who welcomes you, you'll need to know that. So anyway, that's a fairly good start. Why we got in, so it's the basis of the order, but why we need an order, that's another question that maybe I'll attempt to answer. Whenever I talk about anything these days to do with the Dharma, I just always want to start with the Buddha. The Buddha, you know, whose image we have on the shrine, just really is an example of someone who showed us what a human life can be, showed us by exemplification of what a human life can be, that human life can go so far as to go beyond what we usually think of as human. Yeah, it can go so far beyond how we usually experience ourselves. It becomes how human life can become more than human. Usually, unenlightened, all we do is we circle back to me all the time. That could be like the definition of unenlightenment. We just sort of circle back to me. However, you know, sometimes we might manage to sort of attenuate that me, that selfishness for a little while, maybe even for, you know, even maybe even for a few days or a little bit longer. But, you know, sooner or later, if we're unaligned, we'll always come back to me. And my kind of, how I've been glossing this recently is how that's voiced to ourselves usually is, what's in this for me? You know, what can I get out of this? We don't really like to admit that to ourselves, but I think it is true. That sooner or later, usually sooner in my case, is what, you know, what's in this for me? You know, what's the gain for me? Why is this happening to me? And what do people think about me? Yeah, that sooner or later, and I must say in my case, it's usually sooner, we come back to that, yeah? The Buddha's consciousness is a completely new kind of consciousness that goes beyond that. That's what I mean when I say it goes beyond how we usually think of as human. It's more than human, yeah? So that, of course, that's even in a way, if there never had been a Buddha, there would always have been the potential for that. The Dharma's true, through and through. There would always be a potential for that. But the Buddha was the very first being to realize that, to make that sort of real. It was like reality knowing itself for the first time. Yeah. The full potential of reality being reached for the first time. And we're here because we've had a glimpse of that. We must have had a glimpse of that, or we wouldn't be here. We must have had a glimpse of that knowing. That's what's brought us here. And one way you could see ordination is that it's vowing to follow that glimpse. Yeah, it's vowing to, you know, change the metaphor, not let go of that thread. Yeah. We've seen the glimmer of that golden thread. We're vowing not to let go of that. We've had a glimpse that there is life beyond self-clinging. We've been talking about it on this retreat, which I really like, it's from Bhante, that our life is bigger than our ideas about life. I really like that. We've had a glimpse that life is bigger than our ideas about life, and we're putting ourselves behind that glimpse. And we're doing that, we're doing it because when we let go of self-clinging, when we're somehow freed from that, what's in it for me, why is this happening to me, what do people think about me, then and only then actually can we fully be a force for good in the world. To the extent we're still sort of pinging back to what's in it for me, that limits our effectiveness in the world. Obviously, we don't wait till we're completely free. We try and be effective in the world, but we're limited. We're limited to the extent that we're still sort of bound like that. We are limited. In a certain sense, you could even say we're adding to the problem rather than adding to the solution. To that extent, I'm sure we can be good as well. But, well, goodness isn't enough, as Shantideva's told us. Goodness isn't enough. So ordination is in this context, yeah? Okay, so that's the context. The context of ordination is much bigger than ordination. It has to be. It can't just be about this, or else, I don't know. Yeah, it can't just be about this, you know. It's got to be bigger to mean anything at all, yeah? So how I want to talk about ordination is as something active and something creative. So it is something we do. Maybe that's kind of obvious. We are doing something in the ordination ceremony, both parts of it. It's not a passive thing. We are being witnessed, but we're being witnessed in action. Yeah? We're actually doing something. And as we know, as I think we, I can't remember if we heard it in Diane Andy's talk, but if we didn't hear it in Diane Andy's talk, we'd have certainly heard it from our own preceptors in our private ordination ceremony, the private part, that the very heart of the ceremony is the refuges and precepts being taken as vows. Yeah, so we're taking the precepts particularly as vows. I think this is, and I'm going to just go into this, Diane and Andy already touched on it, what do we mean by the precepts being vows? It's a bit scary really, isn't it? It sort of should be really, in a way. I'll go into that, but I think, it's sort of striking me that that's more and more important, and that that's what our training is for. We're training in order to be able to make a vow. I've been saying that, I think I was saying this earlier on the retreat, in my work as mitra convener, when someone asks for ordination, what I say to them these days, when I start to describe what training they'll embark on, I say, the training is in order that you can make a vow, that you can make a solemn vow. That's what we're training for. I think it's very, very important that we know that that's what we're doing. There's a letter I read recently. I kind of slightly hesitated whether to mention it or not, but I will mention it. So I only hesitate because it's a slightly funny thing to say in the proximity of ordination, because it was actually a letter that someone wrote when they were resigning from the order. As you know, from time to time, people do resign from the order. It's actually not that many. It always feels like more, I think, because it matters to us, you know. But it's probably, if you added it up, it's not that many. Anyway, I hope this isn't putting a damper on things mentioning it, but when somebody resigns from the order, they often write a letter to explain the reasons, in a way. It's often very quite moving, but, you know, carefully thought out. Mm-hmm. And that letter is, available for the order to read. Anyway, this letter really, really struck me because it was addressed to the person's preceptor, as they often are, and how it started was, it said, I'm writing to ask you as my preceptor to release me from my ordination vows. Mm-hmm. And I remember thinking, that's exactly right. That's exactly right. Yeah. It's not just something that you just, I don't know, I just thought, that's exactly right. That's what you vowed. And then you had to ask to be released. It was so kind of strong. I thought, you know that funny feeling you think, oh, no, you understand so deeply what ordination is. You should actually be in the order, not leaving it. But I thought that was it. So we're making a vow, and I felt that this person, sadly, who resigned, you know, had understood this very deeply, that we're making something that we then, if we ever wanted to leave, it would be proper to ask permission, to be released, to ask to be released, because we're making it and being witnessed. So we have to be very careful about taking a vow. I was reading in the new book on Milarepa that's just been published that the Tibetans believe that if you take a precept as a vow and break it, then even Padmasambhava can't rescue you. Yeah? In other words, sort of taking a vow and then breaking it is sort of worse than just not doing that thing. You know, like say you took a vow in order to tell a lie, then you told a lie. That's worse than if you'd never done that, because you've not just told a lie, you've broken your vow. And making it in front of a witness, especially your preceptor, is even more strong. And that's why, incidentally, Bhante says, and he says this quite definitely, Bhante's given us 10 precepts rather than, say, like 227 or something, because with 10 you've got a chance of keeping. He explicitly said that. So we take the precepts as vows on the basis of fully intending to observe them, putting ourselves in the conditions to observe them. Now, we intend to observe them. If we break the precept, we haven't broken our vow, as long as you keep going for refuge again, yeah? So it doesn't mean you've necessarily broken your vow every time you break a precept, but it means that to keep the vow means to keep putting yourself in the conditions where you can, you're in the best conditions to keep the precepts. Yeah, that's part of the vow. So in other words, effective commitment, which is what you're all about to do, means you're committed to recommitting yourself. Yeah, that's what you're vowing. So you're committed to recommitting yourself. That's why I always think confession is a sign of a healthy practice, because mm-hmm. you're constantly confessing and committing to recommitting yourself. So that's what you've been training for. Anyway, I hope I haven't put your wool off so far. So that's what you've been training for. See, and you can see quite clearly you have to be integrated to do this, you know. You have to, well, this is idiomatic again, I'll say it then, I'll translate it. I was going to say, you have to have a handle on yourself. You have to have mastery over yourself to be able to make a vow. You have to be integrated. You have to be emotionally positive. Otherwise, you just end up doing it to please people and so on, and that would be all wrong. Yeah. So you could say that's what we've been practicing for. That's what we've been practicing all this time in order to make these vows. Now, on the positive side, so on the positive side, taking a vow or a set of vow that you know you can keep will build your confidence and your capacity as a Dharma practitioner. Build your confidence that you can grow, yeah? I mean, that's why I'm a great believer in the path of responsibility. We keep putting ourselves, you know, we keep sort of committing ourselves to something that's a bit beyond us. I was thinking even coming here, you know? And then you're here, so somehow, you know, you probably all risen to things you thought maybe before you came, I couldn't possibly do lots of things on all levels, from practical to, you know, all sorts of things, you know. So you keep doing that. And right here, and the really important bit is in this case, it's even better than that, because your preceptors are all witnessing that they believe you're ready to do this. Okay, that's what I've been leading up to, you know. That, okay, yes, it's a big thing, it's a kind of drastic thing, but all your preceptors believe that you're ready to do it, you know, and are in the middle of doing it. And I thought maybe I could reassure you even more by saying, like, I'm really strict, right? I'm like really stringent and really strict. So not only have all your individual private preceptors think you're ready to make these vows, but, you know, you've got past me as well. You know? So that's really important, because why I'm saying this is you've almost got this to fall back on. Yeah, you've almost got this to fall back on. That everybody thinks you're ready to do this. Everybody, the whole order in a way, we're standing in, as it were, for the whole order. Everybody in the order believes you're ready to do this. That's good, isn't it? That's a really hard thing that you've got to be really integrated and really emotionally positive to do. Everybody thinks you're ready. Yeah, so that's good. Okay, and yes, of course, you're taking in both parts of the ceremony these precepts, these vows from your preceptors, yeah? So sometimes people, it takes a while for that connection to sink in, but that's why we call preceptors, because you're taking the precepts from us, you know? So again, this ties us in with the lineage that we've been talking about along, so something's handed down. It's more like sparked off than handed down. I love the image of a candle flame, actually. It's quite mysterious, isn't it? Just lighting a candle, you know, and then there's a new flame in a way. There's still the old flame, but there's a new flame. So that's a living tradition, yeah. That's what, this is the spirit of the order. This is what the order is based on, this living, yes, a living tradition. We've already had this brought out in quite a number of the pujas. And again, I brought this to your attention earlier on the retreat. It's a lovely thing. These two new books we've got on Milarepa and the Art of Discipleship. So there's two volumes, and Dhamrati's designed the cover. So both are on one volume, there's a picture of Martha, and on the other, there's a picture of Milarepa. And then you just click them together like this, and they totally fit, and the Dakini appears. the Dakini appears. Try it with the volumes. The Dakini appears. And so it's perfect. I mean, in a way, that's the teaching, isn't it? So you need both. You need both, you could say here, you need both the preceptor and the preceptees, and you need both sides for it to work, and then put them together, and the Dakini appears. So it's a living tradition. And our job, your job, all our jobs actually, whether we're ordained already or not, is to be receptive to that, because this is what the order is based on. This is why it all works, you know. as soon as we lose that, it won't work anymore. You know, as soon as we're not receptive to that darkeny, to that living tradition, well, what will we be? We'll just be this kind of motley bunch of women up a mountain, you know? Really, you know, just what we're, it won't be. And it becomes that through our sort of our power of imagination. We're imaginatively making that. But when I'm saying imagination, I'm not meaning anything. I'm not using that in any pejorative way. Like, we're constantly doing this. We're constantly investing with meaning and then letting that affect us. So we're constantly evoking, then invoking. And we're doing this all the time. I was thinking, we do this, say, with our shrines. I mean, what is this shrine? You know, it's an old chest full of God knows what inside it, as I told you. You know, it has got a Buddha sitting on it, but, you know, one day, for example, we didn't have a Buddha on our heart sutra ritual. We didn't have a Buddha. We just did a circle. We still bowed, you know. Some people, you know, have Buddhas of as ornaments on their mantelpiece, you know. But for us, it's not an ornament or a mantelpiece, you know. We've evoked something and then we invoke, you know, so it affects us, you know. We do the, I don't know what our case is. I mean, what's a case? It's just like, make one in about, I don't know, 2 hours or something, give them the right bits of fabric, you know. Anybody could make one if they wanted, but in itself, it's not actually anything. It's a great, for us, it's become a very, very powerful symbol. That affects us. You know, when I put my keser on, I definitely feel different than when I'm not wearing it, you know. It was interesting, on my last solitary retreat, I wore my keser every time I meditated, and that was quite an important ritual for me, putting my keser on. No one was there to see it, but I put my keser on. And here when I put my keser on, I can't really describe it, but I definitely, something comes a little bit more alive in me, you know. So it's not just a bit of white material. It's been invested with meaning through my imagination and all our imaginations. I find myself bowing to the candles outside, you know, when we just had our candles, because, you know, in a way, like, who would bow to candles? But they weren't candles, you know. They were your offering candles. So they became like a sacred object, you know, that, again, they evoked some, you know, it's that kind of evoking and then invoking, you know. So we're doing that all the time. So that's the spirit of the order. When I say it's a living tradition, and our job is to be constantly alive to that. It's a bit, I think it's, I don't know what the exact word for that aliveness is. It's in the same little clusters, I think, Shraddha, Hri, and Apatrapi, but it's not really Apatrapi, because it's not really to do with ethics, but it's the same sort of family as that, I think. It's definitely in relation to other people. So ordination is active. So I've said something. I think I still have not convinced myself or you, hopefully, that it's a good thing to do. I mean that seriously. I think what I mean is, you know, I'm thinking an intelligent person should need a better reason than that to actually want to join an order, yeah. So I'll try and give you some, and I'll be convincing myself as well, hopefully. So as well as active, it's creative. I want to talk about ordination as a creative act. We talk about committing ourselves to the three jewels. But I was thinking we could talk about committing ourselves to creating the three jewels, yeah? So we could talk about committing ourselves to creating Buddha, to creating Dharma, and to creating Sangha. Not only that, we're committing to doing this together. Yeah, we're committing to doing this together, this act of creativity. And this is very challenging. Doing it together is very challenging. I would say, definitely my own experience, not just of ordination, but just of life, as I've already hinted at, is that sort of going it together is much more challenging than going it alone. Yeah, certainly that's my temperament that finds that. So it's challenging doing it together. So yes, the order is a context for our practice. We're told that a lot, and it is true. It's very true, actually. I was talking to Maitri Vadu when we just arrived, and we both agreed, I think that most of us, including ourselves, are only as good as the company we're in. Yeah, mm-hmm. I think that's true for most of us. Very, very, very difficult to rise above the company we're in. Very, very difficult. Only, I think, very rare individuals can do that. Most of us are very, very influenced by what happens around us. And I think it's as well to realise that and put ourselves in situations that will support our growth. Much, much more influenced than we think we are. So yes, the order is a context. But in a way, I'm not going to focus on that. I hope we know that the order is a context. I want to talk about it also as a test. I mean test in the most positive way. Test in the sense of, you know, test in a strengthening factor to our practice. Yeah, the order is a strengthening factor to our practice. It's a test of spiritual death and rebirth. Other people, basically, are a test of spiritual death and rebirth. I think also they're a test of integration and positive emotion. I can never resist telling my favourite little story. I've told it before in regard to this, but I always remember it. Many, many years ago, I was meeting a friend of mine, Vadra Çakşu. Some of you know he's our man in Istanbul. The only, and before he moved to Istanbul, he lived in London. Anyway, I was meeting him for lunch, and he came along, and I can't remember if I was ordained. Maybe I was just ordained. Anyway, he said, "How are you?" So Vadra met him. I said, "Oh, well," I said, "I was in a great mood earlier." I said, "But, you know, now I've just met kind of so-and-so, and like they've really wound me up, and I'm really grumpy now." And he said, "Well, Sir Bedramati, you obviously weren't as positive as you thought you were." And I just thought that was very, very good, because that's what I mean by we're just tested all the time, you know. We think we're very positive. Well, we might think that. Zen stories are full of this, aren't they? Of people who go off up a mountain, meditate, get into all these higher states, and then, you know, they sort of fall at the first hurdle, you know, the first challenge. They're undone, you know. So the order in particular, because actually it's a context as well, maybe I shouldn't sort of overemphasize the test bit, but maybe I should actually, because it will be. The fact that it's a context makes meaning out of the fact that it's a test, because actually life's a test, isn't it? But the order, because it gives us a chance to work out the altruistic dimension sort of in the real, yeah? And this really will happen, and it already will have happened for you. It will test us. So sometimes we might feel we're not good enough. It will test us in that way. We'll feel that we're not, we can't live up to it. So we'll be tested, and we have to find a way, because we're committed by this time. We've made the vows. So we're going to have to find a way of working with that. Other times we'll think, what am I doing, you know, with this bunch of people, you know? If you're my temperament, yeah, you might feel that quite a lot, actually. The order will disappoint us, you know. Individual people will disappoint us. I hope this isn't shocking to you. Oh dear, I hope this is a suitable talk. I'm not going to bear that the public preceptors will wheel me off. What was I saying?
We'll talk to you after.
We'll talk to you after. Yeah. So why am I saying this?
Creative actors.
Yes, creative. So yes, because we'll be tested and we'll be disappointed. It can't but disappoint us, the Order. It can't but, partly because everyone isn't enlightened, but I tell you, even if everybody was enlightened, we'd still be disappointed, because they'd still be, even, I think if, once anyone's got a human form, they will let, and somehow we will be let down by that human form, you know, even the fact that they would die, you know. We will, even if everybody in the Order was enlightened, we would still experience disappointment, yeah? Yeah, because I think it must only be on the sort of archetypal plane that you wouldn't experience that. While we're embodied, we will be the cause of disappointment in each other. I don't mean we will be, or we'll be the occasion, I should say, that's better, we'll be the occasion of it. So why I'm saying this is, don't think that something's gone wrong if and when that happens. In a way, that's its job, you know. That's the Order's job. Because that's what gives us the chance to work out our altruistic dimension in the real. So very, very, very struck. I always remember the way Bantu talks about Jagdish Kashyap. You'll all remember this, that... but you might not remember it in full, the way Bantu talks about when he decided to do the will of Jagdish Kashyap, yeah? That was a very, very conscious decision of Bantu. He'd been meditating a lot, and we know from his biographies that those meditations were very deep and very, very insightful already. But Bantu knew that that wasn't enough, and he was perplexed. He knew that deep meditation was not enough, that something else had to happen in order to check the, he said, this is how he puts it, to check the motion of the egoistic will. Yeah, and it's the will, he emphasised the will, that meditation alone wasn't doing it, in spite of, you know, as I say, the meditations, you know, were very visionary and insightful. And that was why he consciously decided to do the will of Jagdish Kashyap. It was a spiritual practice. And of course, it's rather funny, isn't it? Because for ages, Jagdish Kashyap didn't really ask him to do anything, and he was hoping he would. But then eventually, you know, he did. He asked him to stay in Kalimpong and work for the good of Buddhism. And Bantu was overjoyed to do that, because he'd already made up his mind that that was what he would do. So we need something bigger than us to serve, yeah? So when I say that that's the job of the Order, to test our altruistic dimension of our practice, that's what I mean. That we need something bigger than us to serve. And the Order, in a way, can be this for us, yeah? The Order can be this for us. When we join the Order, we're consciously saying, we're consciously allowing sort of like our own will not to be our own will. Now, I want to qualify what I mean by this, because it's, you've got to understand this quite carefully. This is why we've got to be integrated and have a depth of positive emotion before you, otherwise you get, it's easy to get this wrong. So we have to have something bigger than us to serve. When we, and I'm saying we can allow the Order to be that bigger something. So when we consciously do that, if we serve something bigger than us, it's not our will, but it's not our will at the same time. Do you see what I mean? It's not just simply we're kind of handing over our will, but neither is it just our will anymore. It's a little bit like, and Bantu talks about it like this, when someone we love asks us to do something, someone we love very much, you can no longer tell whose will it is anymore. It's no longer, it's not our will just because they've asked us to do it, but it's not really their will because we willingly do it. I suppose maybe that's another way of putting it. We willingly do the will of something that's bigger than us, and the Order can be that. We willingly do the will. That's the important bit, that we willingly do that. I must say, I felt this very clearly when I was asked to be a public preceptor. It's the sort of thing you don't really, you can't really, well, I don't think anyone in the right mind would really want to, in a sense, you know. Not really want to in the sense of want to with their own will. It must be the same being the chair of a centre and so on. You can't really want to. But at the same time, I knew the minute I was asked directly by Dharma Dinner. I remember it was quite clearly articulated in my own sort of mind and heart. I knew what I thought to myself was, if I say no, to say no to this request would be saying no to my own life. To say no to this request would be saying no to my own life. I could not say no, but I'd never have volunteered myself, you know, not for my own sake, you know. I would have to help, obviously. I wanted to help, but do you see what I mean? This is quite important, that this thing about when we're talking about something bigger than us to serve. Is that sort of clear? Yeah. So as I say, you can only serve like this on the basis of integration, sort of being a whole person on positive emotion. You cannot do it otherwise. This is a really good thing. See, I am getting onto something positive. That is really, really growthful. Yeah, that is really, really growthful. Well, certainly I found that in my own experience. So in a way, not only have you served, but you yourself have grown. So that's why I was thinking in terms of creating Buddha, you yourself have, it's like a bigger mind has been created in you. You can't really say creating a bigger mind, but a bigger mind has been created in you if you can serve like that, to the extent you can. One grows. Certainly that's been my experience. So seeing it as a context and a support and a test, we're creating Buddha. The order, of course, is a vehicle for the Dharma. That's quite clear, isn't it? And I think that's come out in some of the pujas and the talks already. Very, very interesting, isn't it, that the Buddha did realise enlightenment without an order, sort of unique individual did that, and I'm sure other individuals have. But interesting, in the case of the Buddha, the very, very first thing he did was create an order. So that's the first thing an enlightened being would do, would be create an order. And in that creating the order, they create a vehicle for the Dharma. To tell you the truth, they're probably not actually thinking like that in those words. It's probably the Buddha didn't cognitively think, oh yes, now I'm enlightened, I know what I'll do, I better start an order so the Dharma flourishes. You know, I think it was much more spontaneous, you know, wasn't it, his teaching of the Dharma. He went to, well, first of all, he thought of his teachers, then he thought of, you know, the five ascetics, the people he knew, you know, it was just an impulse. If when you realise something wonderful, you just want to share it with people you think will understand and people that you care about. So it would have been an impulse, I think. I don't think it would have been, oh yes, this is why. At the same time, because he did that, that's why we still have the Dharma. So the order is a vehicle for the Dharma. It's very, very interesting. And we've been focusing a lot, as is right, on the early stories. In a way, the stories of the Buddha before he was the Buddha. All the going forths, the sort of multiple going forths of Siddhartha before he became the Buddha. So you've got those stories at the sort of beginning, in a way. If you look to the end of the Buddha's life in the Parinibbana Sutta, it's all relational, you know, the whole thing. It's beautiful, aren't they, the stories there? It's all connection with other people, lovely, tender connections with other people. I haven't got time to sort of tell them all, but very, very touching, all those stories of the last days of the Buddha's life, and all to do with with others. And right up to virtually the very last thing that the Buddha did was ordain Subhadra. He didn't just teach Subhadra, he ordained Subhadra. It's very, very interesting now, because he also sort of broke the rules to ordain Subhadra. I was wondering about that. There must be some significance in that. Subhadra had come, and you remember Ananda wasn't going to let him in, but then the Buddha said no, because the Buddha, you know, was about to pass away. But then Ananda does say to, then the Buddha says to Ananda, no, do invite Subhadra in, it's proper. And the Buddha teaches him, but then because Subhadra's in another order, he's meant to wait a certain amount of time. I think it might even be 7 years or something, seven months, or a long time anyway. And but the Buddha says, no, you don't have to wait, I'm going to ordain you right now. So he sort of breaks some sort of rule. I don't quite know what the significance of it is, but maybe, I'm just thinking as I speak here, maybe it's, maybe what that meant was that virtually the last act of the Buddha was to conduct an ordination. Yeah, he didn't wait, because, you know, the Buddha would have passed away if he'd waited. So it meant that Subhadra was ordained by the Buddha. So that's the very last thing that the Buddha does, is an ordination. And yes, if there's no order, the Dharma's teaching wouldn't have survived. And I remember this, again, this is a story I often tell, but it really, really struck me, actually. It must have been 10 years ago now, because it was the 30th anniversary of the London Buddhist Centre, and Bhante came to preside, and he was being interviewed by Maitreya Bender. And I remember Maitreya Bender saying quite a heartfelt question. He said, Bhante, you know, are we doing the right thing, you know, having a big urban Buddhist centre? Shouldn't we be off in the mountains meditating? And what I remember is Bhante just looked so surprised, and he said, but this is where the people are. and then Maitreya Bhante asked him again. He said, but Bhante, are you really sure? Or something. And again, Bhante just said, but this is where the people are. And I think it was, I reflected on that, and I thought, I mean, obviously I don't know what was in the mind of Bhante or any other person, but I thought, if you were Bhante, that must be the most important thing, or out of anything, must be that the Dharma's teaching survives. That must be the most important thing. It won't survive forever. We know that. It won't survive forever as teaching. I think it's really important that we realise that. As truth, of course, it's eternal, but it will not survive as teaching. If you're Bhante, if you're the Buddha, the imperative must be that it survives as long as possible, that it's alive as long as possible. And the best way for that survival is to create an order. It must be. No individual can, no matter how sort of talented and gifted, an individual can't do that. The way that that can be done is through an order. It's something like creating a culture to get through an order. We can create a culture together where people can flourish in the Dharma. And that has to be done collectively. You can't create, one person can't create a culture. It can only be done collectively. Of course, then you've got two things, haven't you? You've got, and then, you know, you're creating a culture, and you must also keep practicing. I mean, the culture is only as good as the people in it. We can only preserve the Dharma by practicing it, by embodying it. So we're individually practicing the Dharma, and we're creating together a culture where the Dharma as teaching can survive, hopefully long into the future. So the sort of last thing I want to say, and I think this is the most, well, I don't know if it's the most important or not, actually. Hopefully some of what I've said is a bit important. It's hard to tell, isn't it? I feel like it is, as I say, I feel like it is something I'm still trying to sort of work out myself. And maybe always will be, in a way. Maybe that's the point, that one's always trying to work out what it means to be an order member, to have joined an order. I think, you know, Well, maybe the day you stop trying to work that out, the day in that in a way you stop being an order member, when you stop trying to work out what it is to be an order member. But anyway, be that as it may, the last thing I'm going to say anyway is that joining the order, I think, reflects reality. It reflects how things actually are. And that this is enacted in our ordination ceremony, particularly in the fact that our ordination ceremony has these two parts. And it's amazing, actually, in a way, Banti's genius. I don't know if we always had these two parts of the ceremony, did we, right from the beginning? Anyway, we've got them now, and I think it struck me more forcibly on this retreat than ever before. But these two parts are simply reflecting reality. Maybe this is all I should have said, really. Because life itself has got these two aspects. Life has two parts, in a way, or two aspects. It's got the sort of inner, hasn't it, our inner world, and then it's got the relational. This is life. Life's got the inner and the relational. And in our Dharma life, hopefully, these start to become wisdom and compassion. That's what we're trying to do with our Dharma life. And I think this is exactly reflected in the ordination ceremony. It's great, isn't it? It's exactly reflected in the ordination ceremony. Why don't I just say that? This is exactly reflected in this. And a recent talk I was listening to by Maitreya Bendu, he calls them the systole and diastole. This is lovely, actually, because that's the movement of the heart. I can't remember which way around it is, but, you know, the heart. In one single heart, but you get this, you know, the heart contracts and does something. I don't know, does whatever hearts do when they contract, but that's important, isn't it? And then it relaxes, you know, so it's, contracts, relaxes. That's a heartbeat. It's got both sides. I know the medical people know what that means. It's to do with the blood getting pumped through. But anyway, and we all know that heart has got this beating aspect, the systole and diastole, yeah? The private and public is that beating heart. And the brilliant thing about this image is that they're not distinct. We experience them as distinct. The brilliant thing about the heartbeat is it's one heartbeat has got those two aspects, yeah? So from our point of view, wisdom and compassion say, from our point of view, we see those as opposites. From our point of view, we see the inner and the relational as separate, yeah? We move between them. At our best, we move between them. You know, sometimes we do quite well and we get quite a good flow between them. But still, we see them as a sort of opposite, really. But say from... I haven't got Tara on the shrine anymore. I was talking about this earlier, this retreat. Say Tara, or say the Buddha here with one hand up or one hand touching the earth. All these figures that have got these opposite gestures, Tara with one hand in meditation, one hand out. We see them as two gestures. From Tara's point of view, it's the same thing. It's the same thing. This is the really, really important thing. You know, we see Avalokiteshvara with hands joined and thousand arms. We see that as sort of two gestures or many gestures or two movements, a movement inward and a gesture outward. But from the point of view of the enlightened figure, these are not distinct, yeah? They're not distinct. When we're enlightened, if we're not enlightened yet, we will know them as one gesture, like that single heartbeat. That's the heartbeat of enlightenment. So Banti puts it very, very finely. He says that the opposite gestures, for example, what we think of as the each, is unopposed to what we think of as the opposite. Very fine that, isn't it? Unopposed to what we think of as the opposite. Yeah, so we think, yeah, this outward movement and this inward movement are the opposite, wisdom, compassion, two things that one flows from the other even. But actually each is unopposed to what we unenlightened think of as the opposite. So the more we see this, then the more we're in harmony with reality, the more we understand it. And so this is the brilliant thing, that the fact that we've got one ordination with these two parts, we are enacting a wisdom teaching here. We are enacting in the ordination a reflection of the fact that when we're enlightened, what looks like two things is one experience, a whole. Yeah. Okay. So that's what we're doing. That's as far as I've got, you know, in my understanding of what I'm doing as an order member. What I like to do when I leave is kind of clear this up, and if I come back in 1 year or 2 years, I hope I'd be able to give you a new talk, yeah? Because I hope I can still keep working this out for the rest of my life. But that's as far as I've got, so I'm just going to finish by just kind of, in a way, maybe taking us back to the beginning of my talk, which is to say that for a meaningful life, we need values that transcend me, each of us, we need that, and we need to commit to those values. When we do that, the more we do that, each time we do that, I say it'll feel true. We've already done it, actually, and we're ongoingly doing it. It feels true, doesn't it? And it feels true because it's in accord with the nature of reality itself, because the nature of reality itself is pointing to that non-separation. That's why each time we step beyond selfishness, it doesn't just feel positive, it feels true, it feels sort of simple, it feels like there's a truth to it, we feel that, yeah? So the nature of reality itself is pointing to that non-separation, yeah? And the symbol of that for our order is Avalokiteshvara. So all the elements of Bhante's presentation of the Dharma are ritually enacted in our ordination ceremony. And this is just the beginning, yeah? We're going to spend the rest of our lives working out the full implications of this, or trying to. Actually, we'll never get there, actually. We'll never, ever understand. Is this true, what I'm saying? Well, I think it is true. We'll never understand what ordination is. We'll never understand it. But we've got to keep trying. It's the attempt to understand it that is the important thing. It's a bit like, say we try and make an image of the Buddha, we'll never do it. We'll never be able to make an image of the Buddha. We'd never be able to paint Tara. We'd never be able to paint the refuge tree, embroider Vajrasattva. You'd never be able to do it. You'll never be able to do it, but you've got to attempt it. It's the attempt itself that's the thing. So actually, what I'd like to say is we'll never understand why we're getting ordained or why we have got ordained. We never should, you know, but we've got to keep trying. And the attempt is the important thing. That's what I think anyway. So I hope you're all still going to do it. So I look forward to that coming into being. And I think I really have reached the limit of what I've got to say. So thank you for listening.